This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know that the first man in space was Yuri Gagarin, of course, of the Soviet Union. You know that the first American in space was Alan Shepard aboard the Mercury capsule in 1961. And the first woman in space, maybe a little bit tougher, you know that answer. It was Russian Valentina Tereshkova, of course, in 1963. You knew that. But I'll bet you never heard of Jerry Cobb or Jerry Sloan, B. Stedman, Jan and Marion Dietrich. Their names aren't in the history books, but they were among 13 women pilots who in the early 1960s passed the same qualifying tests as the original seven male Mercury astronauts, proving themselves to be every bit as capable as America's first space heroes. Testing of the best women pilots in the early days of the space race was part of a little-known effort to get an American woman into space, an effort that, of course, didn't succeed until over two decades later when Sally Ride rode the Space Shuttle Challenger into orbit, and that was 20 years ago this week. So how come these women, the fellow lady astronaut trainees, never made it into space? We had a female Soviet cosmonaut. Why didn't we have a female American astronaut in the early days? And why did it take more than 20 years after Alan Shepard's space flight for an American woman, a woman to make it into space? Well, this hour we're going to hear the story of these 13 women and talk with one of our country's first woman astronauts, Ray Seddon, a three-time shuttle veteran. And if you'd like to talk about it, we'd be more than happy to help you join in. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can go over to our website at sciencefriday.com for links to today's topic. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Ray Seddon is a former NASA astronaut and the assistant chief medical officer at the Vanderbilt Medical Group in Nashville, Tennessee. She joins us from Cocoa Beach, Florida, where her husband, Robert L. Gibson, is among the astronauts being inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame. Welcome and congratulations, Dr. Seddon.
Well, thank you very much, Ira. It's good to be with you.
Good. Thank you for taking time out of that to talk with us.
You bet.
Stephanie Nolan is the author of Promised the Moon, the untold story of the first women in the space race. It's out next month from Four Walls, Eight Windows Press. She's also a foreign affairs reporter for the Globe and Mail in Toronto. And she joins us today from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. Welcome to the program, Ms. Nolan.
Hi, thanks very much.
Thank you. Ray, you were one of the six who were the first official women astronauts. Tell us how you made it into that group.
Well, Ira, you know, I sort of found out about the selection process by chance and filled out an awful lot of forms to apply, and then was lucky enough to get an interview, had some of the right science and background credentials, and was lucky enough to get into the astronaut program. We were selected in 1978.
So you didn't go in as a fancy NASA pilot like the old timers did?
No, I didn't. Luckily, when they started selecting space shuttle astronauts, they decided that there would be pilot astronauts and what they called mission specialists, which were people without the background in flying, but with science and engineering backgrounds.
Did you find it surprising that it took 20 years to get a woman into space, on the American side at least?
Yeah, kind of. You know, I think we owe a debt of gratitude to the women who kind of raised a ruckus about it back then, but I think NASA just wasn't ready for that and made the decision to open it only to men.
All right, Stephanie, tell us about those women who were raising the ruckus. What was that interesting program that I don't think any of us had heard about until your book?
No, and in fact, that's how I wound up writing the book, because when I heard a little snippet about it, those women in the 60s who, didn't get to be astronauts, I said, hang on, how did I miss that story?
Yeah.
How can there have been 13
Walter
women
Walter Cronkite
who...
didn't cover that part of the space.
No, and that wasn't in my history book. And so it took a lot of digging. It took a lot of digging to find them, and then even more to piece together the story of what happened. But in a nutshell, the problem was that in the late 1950s, the Soviets were clearly winning the space race. They were much closer to the big prize of launching a man. And the problem that NASA had was that its rockets were not big enough to launch a capsule that would hold a person. And so a doctor called Randy Lovelace, who was a bit of a maverick scientist, but he was the head of NASA's Life Sciences Committee and responsible for selecting the Mercury 7, he said, well, we need a bit of a brainwave. Kind of obvious if you think about it. What if we took somebody who passed all those same tests, but who was 4 inches shorter and 40 pounds lighter, a woman, and sent her? That would be 40 precious pounds of weight, which was really important by the standards they were talking about. And Dr. Lovelace also knew that preliminary research on women had shown they were more tolerant of pain, more tolerant of isolation, better able to withstand the radiation of space. And so it seemed to him like a no-brainer. We'll try female astronauts and see if they cut it on these tests. He started testing female pilots and discovered that, in fact, they did as well or better as the Mercury men had on these tests. And pretty soon he had a whole cadre of female pilots he was ready with.
And these were called the fellow lady astronaut trainees?
That's what they called themselves, lady astronauts.
Lady astronaut. And so this is a good beginning to the story. Continue the story. What happened?
Well, the leader of this group was a woman called Jerry Cobb, who at that point was probably one of the most famous female pilots in the country. She had 7,000 hours of flying time, which, just to put that in perspective, was 5,000 more flying hours than John Glenn had. And she held records. She held flight records in height, distance, altitude. She was a crack pilot, and she was one of the few women who had a senior job in aviation in the country. And the other women they're all very different, this group of 13. 11 of them are still alive, and I've had the privilege of spending time with all of them, and they're a very diverse group. But the thing they all have in common is that they, from the time they were little girls, they were desperate to fly. And they, against considerable barriers in the industry and people's mistrust of female pilots, they had all managed to build up 1,200 flying hours of commercial flying time, which was the minimum requirement. Dr. Lovelace screens a whole bunch of women, ends up with this group of 13, and says, you know, okay, let's try this. And essentially what happens is that the sort of bigwigs at NASA and eventually, in fact, Lyndon Johnson, get wind of this and say, no way. And no what way. They run into is just classic discrimination. Nobody, you know, the Mercury 7 are at this point the embodiment of American heroism, and nobody thinks a chick in a ponytail should be making the big American achievement, right? This doesn't look good. This is not about heroism. And so very abruptly, in September of 1961, when these women are just about ready to start formal training, they get a telegram that says, it's all off, it's canceled, forget it, go home. And they don't hear anything more about it. Well, almost nothing more about it for 40 years. In fact, until they read my book, most of them didn't know what happened.
Wow. Sounds like, you know, the movie A League of Their Own with the female baseball players.
It's A League of Your Own, but in space.
In space. Mm-hmm. Wow. Ray, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, that's the decision that was made back then. And as Stephanie points out, women were discriminated against in a lot of ways back then that was sort of taken for granted. I think what they did require back then that they didn't give women a chance to get was test pilot, high-performance jet time, and test pilot school with the military. And they made that a requirement, and women were not allowed into those ranks, and so they had an excuse for it. But it was simply that the decision was made to stick with male pilots. And in some ways it made the design of the spacecraft a little easier. People say, well, you know, how could women go to the bathroom? It's easier to put an external catheter on men, and so that's the way they designed it. They said most women are too short. Well, you know, they had just designed all of the equipment to meet sort of a mid-range male, and that made it, I guess, a little less expensive than trying to open up the design a bit. And
Dr. Seddon, if I can interrupt, I'd love to know, when you started in the 80s, how prepared were they for women at that point? How many of those problems did you run into?
Well, things had to be redesigned. I mean, quite definitely, I'm on the smaller side. I'm 5'2 and a half. They had to design basically diapers for us, but that was not a challenge that couldn't have been carried out in the early 60s instead of in the late 70s. There were a lot of pieces of equipment that we sort of had to retrofit for smaller people. We had to learn to do some things in a little bit different way than the men did because I was smaller and not quite as strong. But none of those things would have been impossible in the early 60s had they decided to do it.
Did you experience any, you know, hazing or razzing or anything like that when you got in the program?
Not at all. I mean, when we have a national will to do something, I think people get on board with it. And it was just that decision. It's like people asked me earlier today in an interview, when are we going to go to Mars? And I say, when we decide we're going to do it. And I think they probably could have taken women back then if they had decided to do it, as they did in the late 70s.
Huh. You know, I find interesting about reading in your book, Stephanie, about Valentina Tereshkova. She was sort of, she was just a trick. I mean, just a gimmick. From reading
she was a propaganda move on Khrushchev's
right.
part, and this is really interesting because it was interesting on two levels. First of all, it was when they launched her, the Soviets sort of boasted about how this showed the equality of the two systems. And it's only in the last decade or so when papers from the Soviet space program have been made public that space historians have put together the fact that actually she wasn't at all a fully participating member of their space program, that she wasn't allowed the autonomy, the input that male astronauts were, that she was mocked and sort of mistreated within the Soviet system. And while they were heralding her achievement in the outside world, she was in fact treated very badly at home once she'd kind of served the purpose. And for the women
She didn't have a career in flying, Stephanie.
No.
I mean, she made one flight and then she was, I guess, put on the PR trail, and she never had an opportunity to really have a career in cosmonaut
course. But Stephanie points out in her book that was on purpose. They didn't want to fly her, right?
Exactly.
They didn't, yeah.
And it was interesting, too, because she became, you know, obviously once NASA had launched Alan Shepard, and particularly once John Glenn had done an orbital trip, then this first reason for using women, them being smaller and lighter, had been removed. So Jerry Cobb and the other women, but Jerry in particular, seized on this idea of an American first. And they said the Soviets had the first satellite, and they had the first man in space, and they had the first joint mission in space. But okay, we can have the first woman. And they said, won't this be great? We can beat them on this. And she was totally tone deaf to the national mood. And if you read the American coverage of Valentina's flight, you sort of see that nobody in the American public at large, and particularly at NASA, nobody thought the Soviets had made a great achievement. In fact, the internal stuff I read from NASA at the time was sort of embarrassed. Like, what do they think they've achieved? They've launched a girl. You know, cringe, cringe. This wasn't anything heroic at all. And so Jerry was completely out of step with the national mood on that one.
Whatever happened to Randy Lovelace, who thought up this great idea?
Randy Lovelace was killed in a plane crash not too long after he had started this program, which is one of the many interesting questions about how they didn't get to go. I don't think they would ever have been first. I don't think they ever would have been as early as Jerry wanted. But I wonder if he lived, if he might have been able to advocate for them. But even Jerry, once the White House got involved, even Randy, he had a personal stake at NASA. He had a good position there. He had access to a lot of important research material and funding. So when he saw NASA's very adverse reaction to using women, he backed right off, and he wasn't prepared to risk the things he gained from an association with NASA for this idea of using women.
So you think that maybe that if Randy had lived, women might have come in a little bit earlier, but certainly not before, you know, the Apollo missions, though.
Well, you know, Ira, when you think back on it, the last selection before mine in 1978 was in 1969. And I think that the women's movement was growing during those years. And so there was a long time between the time they took the last sort of Apollo group or Skylab group and the time that they took our group. So in that 10 years, I think the world changed tremendously.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of why. Perhaps it took a long time. If they'd been selecting groups every 2 or 3 years, might have happened sooner, but it took a long time to get the shuttle flying.
All right, Dr. Seddon, hang on. Stephanie Nolan, hang on. We're going to take a short break and come back and take listener questions and talk more about the Women in Space program. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about women in space, the history of women in space, I guess, and current history, too. My guests are Stephanie Nolan, author of Promised the Moon, the untold story of the first women in the space race. It's actually out next month from Four Walls, Eight Windows, and she's also a foreign affairs reporter for the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Ontario. Ray Seddon, former NASA astronaut and assistant chief medical officer at the Vanderbilt Medical Group in Nashville, Tennessee. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about when women finally did get the go-ahead to get on the shuttle. I would have thought, you know, that by the 70s, I guess women were not in training anymore for the astronaut corps, that might have been somebody on a late Apollo mission to the moon. You know, there are three seats up there.
Again, if we decided to do that, we could have.
Well, and that issue that Dr. Seddon raised earlier about test piloting is really important, that it was the excuse that NASA used to keep these women out, but it's also really important to note that they did not have the jet pilot, they didn't have jet test piloting experience, which, of course, all the Mercury 7 had. And it was, if you look at the, it's fascinating, and I bless you in the United States for your love of your own history and the way you preserve your records, because it was great for me doing the research. But you can see the process that Eisenhower went through when he decided that it would be jet test pilots who would be the first astronauts, and it was pretty random. I mean, it wasn't at all set in stone, but the reality was the only people in the 50s and 60s flying, until the late 60s, flying jets really is the Air Force, and women aren't allowed into the Air Force until the late 1970s. They're not allowed to do this kind of flying. So there were no women with this experience. And when they finally open up the astronaut corps to more than just pilots, then it suddenly opens up to all kinds of people, you know, medical doctors like Dr. Seddon. But it was very interesting for me, these women that I was writing about, most of whom are still alive and still flying, they were excited about Sally Ride. They were excited about this first group of candidates, but they didn't really feel vindicated until 1995, when Lieutenant Colonel Eileen Collins was the first woman to pilot the shuttle, because then they finally felt like their kind of astronaut had gone to space.
Ray, did you ever meet any of these women? Did you know about them?
Yes, I've met Jerry Cobb and Wally Funk, and they're just tremendous folks, and they have so much to tell all of us, and I'm so glad that Stephanie's captured their story, because they did really try hard, and they were just a little bit ahead of their time. I feel very grateful to them. In some ways, it's humbling, because they wanted to do that so badly. They were so well qualified, and yet they were just not allowed to do it. And those of us who sort of happened along at the right time, who kind of wanted to do this but had other plans in case it didn't happen, I don't think we had to work nearly as hard as they worked, and they didn't get the payoff.
Well, representing such history and being one of the original women astronauts, did you feel a lot of pressure then on your first shuttle mission?
I think all of us did early on. All of us had to sort of make decisions about how hard we wanted to pursue this. All of us, of course, felt like we were at the beginning of something important, and we didn't want to mess it up for all of the other women that were coming behind us. Certainly, we knew that pilots were sort of in the ranks getting ready to go. I think there was a good bit of pressure on us, certainly on Sally making the first flight. But we were well accepted at NASA. We were well trained. Everybody felt like they had a stake in our success. And so I think that made it easier. Once NASA decided to do this, we were welcomed into the astronaut corps, and whatever it took, we were all going to fly. And we all did fly. And, you know, I think we answered the question about whether women could fly or not. Certainly Eileen and the other women pilots have proven that they're perfectly capable of piloting the spacecraft. So I think those questions are being answered, and women are given full opportunity now.
You've been on three separate shuttle missions, correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
How do you give up that line of work?
Well, you know, you do it for, I was with NASA for 19 years and made three flights. I also had three children along the way, and, you know, somehow that
it's a long time between missions.
Pardon?
It's a long time between missions.
Well, actually, yes, but, of course, I think there comes a time when you sort of feel like you want to leave all of this fun flying to some other young, bright people, and there are an awful lot of people lined up wanting to do it.
When you see this commission now investigating the last shuttle tragedy, do you feel like you should have been more fearful when you were up there?
No, I think, you know, all of us who flew were aware of the danger areas. We were aware every time we went that we might not come back. Certainly those of us who were there during Challenger, we were especially attuned to not only the fact that something could happen to you, but that it's very difficult for your family when something like that happens. And so much in the public view and so much to deal with that you wouldn't have if, you know, if your husband died of a heart attack or even crashed a military plane. Mm. So I think that we're aware of that, but your heart breaks for the people that have to go through it. It's still a very dangerous business.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Jim in Junction City, Wisconsin.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Yes. Thank you, Ira, for taking my call. I would like to ask your guest if they ever think, I'm 50 years old, that in my lifetime, will they ever have a manned mission to Mars? And, you know, if they did, would they just, you know, love to be on it? Because I am fascinated with space, and I hope we have a manned mission to Mars while I'm still around. And, you know, hopefully I got a little bit of time left.
And how you feel?
Well, you know, I think those of us, and now the term is a human mission to Mars, not man.
A staffed mission.
Right. People in space, people to Mars.
Some of the greatest film heroes now are women. You know, the astronauts are alien. Well, that's, you know, that's the women are the ones who are.
But I think, again, if we have the national will to do it and we put the strength and intelligence and financial support that this country can provide, there will be. If we don't decide to do it, it's going to take an awful lot of time with the current NASA budget to get there.
Of course, the original space race was a political move. I mean, we don't have any politics here to
exactly.
get us. Unless the Chinese decide.
That's a wild card now. The Chinese are about to start a flight program putting, I don't know what they're going to call them, astronauts or cosmonauts or a different Chinese word, and perhaps there will be a race with them at some point in time.
One can only hope. 1-800-989-8255. What surprised you, Stephanie, of all the research you were doing? What did you uncover? I mean, you were shocked, you said, at the beginning from just learning about these women. But was it all downhill from there?
Well, I guess the thing that was a constant source of fascination for me, I'm 31 years old, and so it's 40 years ago. For me, I mean, I'm in a line of work where there aren't very many women. I just spent 3 months in Iraq for the war. A lot of times I was the only female reporter around, but I've never really felt there wasn't something I couldn't do. To read about the things these women went through to fly, the kinds of incredible discrimination. They used to fly, even though it was sort of perilous, they'd fly in high-heeled shoes and skirts because, you know, that was the only way to kind of make it acceptable.
Really?
Yeah. Jerry Kahn,
just like the ball players.
When she set her distance record, she had to wriggle out of her flight suit and into pantyhose and a girdle in the plane while she was bringing it into land because it wouldn't be appropriate for her to be photographed in trousers when she landed. And so, you know, in the kinds of the attitude people's boss had, even these women won a hearing before Congress in July of 62, and the star witnesses for NASA were John Glenn and Scott Carpenter, and the kinds of really crude jokes that John Glenn was able to make and have all the kind of, you know, have the senators and the congressmen laughing it up. Maybe many of these attitudes actually still endure within the military or within NASA today, but you couldn't say these things publicly, at least. And so it was a constant shock for me that this, just how different the world was only 40 years ago.
Because we only had, not a short time ago, all these women before working in the factories at home while the men were in World War II proving their abilities to do these things.
Yeah,
and they weren't wearing their high heels and, you know, hoop skirts then.
No, and in fact, some of these women actually flew. For the first time women were allowed to fly for the United States military, the only time before the 70s, was the women Air Force service pilots who were ferry pilots in the 40s. But of course, you know, into the 50s and the nuclear family and home in the suburbs, that had all gone out the window. And so a 21-year-old had a real struggle convincing an airport manager to hire her. And if she did get a job, she got the absolute worst flying jobs. You certainly weren't getting to fly in the new fancy planes.
that was so true. And, you know, we look back on it now and think how primitive they were, that there were so many jobs that women were just not allowed to do because, you know, there was this sort of feeling that we must protect them from this, or they're not big enough, or they're not strong enough, or they're not smart enough. And those, you know, we've just found that those things were just not true. And
yeah.
We look back on it
and
laugh.
NASA's whole argument about why they couldn't fly a woman was, well, if a woman were to get killed, that'd be a disaster. Bad enough if we, God forbid, lose John Glenn. But if a woman dies in the Mercury capsule, that'll be the end of it for NASA. The country will never get over their horror. Like, somehow it's different to lose a female astronaut. Mm. Although, if you look at the reaction of a Challenger accident, you know, we talk about Krista McAuliffe, I think, because she's remembered for these very feminine values of being a mother and a teacher. We don't hear nearly as much about Judith Resnick, who was there for sort of more traditionally male values as a scientist.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our next phone call. It might have something to do with that line. And Myra in Madisonville, Kentucky. Hi, Myra.
Hi, Ira. Thank you for taking my call. I was just calling to make a comment in defense of NASA and maybe a little anti-feminist comment here, but I really don't think that back in the 60s our country would have rallied behind the space effort had we decided to send a woman instead of a man. I just don't think our country was ready for that. And I also have a follow-up question on that. I wonder if any of these women that the lady wrote the book about, if any of them felt bitter about her, or if they really, you know, understand that, you know, there's just the context of the time in which they live that just didn't make this possible.
Hmm.
Well, you know, they're all very different. And there were some who kind of shrugged and said, well, you know, that's the way it is right now. I've been up against this all my life flying. You know, it's a disappointment and I'll move on. And there were others who wanted this more than anything. And Dr. Seddon identified Jerry and Wally Funk. And I think for them in particular, I learned this about pilots writing the book. Pilots always want to go higher, go faster, go further. And to fly in space is the ultimate goal for a pilot. And these women wanted this desperately. And Jerry Cobb says, I'd have given my life for this. I'd have given my life for it in 1961. I'd give my life for it now. She still wants to go. Mm-hmm. She's still flying. She says if John Glenn can go as a geriatric astronaut, so should I.
Yeah, that was my next question. But could it have been that the male pilots themselves would have felt outraged by female companions or female colleagues or upstaged by them? I'm thinking of when Jackie Kennedy was first lady. She, you know, the president used to, you know, President Kennedy, when he went to France, for example, he would say, I'm the guy who took Jackie around Paris because she was so upstaging him. Might they have felt threatened by female pilots?
Well, I can tell you that, you know, when we first came in, when women first came in, there was such a news blitz about women, and everywhere we went there were reporters who wanted to ask us, you know, how we had enjoyed water survival training and whether anyone had been hurt in parasail training, and you know, we're the ones that got interviewed. And I felt like the men didn't really appreciate that very much, but I think they understood that we were not there to make names for ourselves. That was just mm-hmm. the way it was. I think that we were very well accepted. We got the same kinds of jobs that the men were assigned to. They certainly taught us how to fly the NASA jets. I felt like that, and perhaps there was some undercurrent with the Apollo astronauts that were still there, that they were not really sure of this. They were of a different generation, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I think when the decision was made to do this, that they all were willing to help us to fly.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the space race of women in space this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, with my guest Stephanie Nolan and Dr. Ray Seddon. Stephanie, did you want to jump in there with something?
I think that that's very true, that the difference of that generation between the late 50s and the late 1970s made a huge difference. You can see in NASA's correspondence that survives that, and I don't even think it was really very malicious, or it wasn't personally malicious on behalf of the Mercury 7 or the men around them. The idea was preposterous. They came out of this elite, very masculine world of test piloting, and the idea that women would come and do this was just completely ridiculous. It just jeopardized the public image of the program, and the women just had no place in NASA as an institution at the time. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they would have gotten over it and been welcoming, but the kinds of things they had to say about it in public at the time, they were mocking and actually quite ungracious. And I mean, John Glenn continued to be not very gracious about it for a long time. And I don't think that these women, even if there had been an executive decision to include them, I don't think they would have had an easy time.
Well, I can tell you that there were some Apollo astronauts that had left the program by the time we got in, and they, like you say, Stephanie, they were not very gracious about it, and they did make jokes about it, and it was hurtful to those of us who were serious about doing this job. And perhaps some of the older folks were not very accepting, but I think we just had to prove that we were going to do a good job.
Did your women astronauts feel that you had to stick together like a group?
To a certain extent, yes. Of course, when Sally was first selected for the first flight, she was very good about including us all in the decisions that were made about, you know, the equipment that she was going to take or how she was going to do things. And I think we were a mm-hmm. tight-knit group. I don't think that we had to face many battles. It was just sort of, you know, how can we all get together and decide, you know, what we ought to do about this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether to take makeup, how to test out the toilet,
mm-hmm.
Just things like that. And I think we worked together as a pretty good team.
Were you disappointed you weren't chosen to be the first one?
Well, you know, we talked about a little bit about decisions when we first came in. My husband and I were married in 1981, and they were beginning to think about choosing women. But to tell you the truth, I wanted to start a family. And so about that time, about several months after we married, I did get pregnant, and so I sort of was out of the running. So at least I can say, well, that's the reason perhaps that I was not selected. But I think Sally was an excellent choice, and all of us felt that she did a superb job, and we were very proud of her.
Would you have done anything differently looking back?
No.
Pretty happy.
I wanted to have a life besides being an astronaut.
All right. I want to thank both of you for taking time to talk with us. Dr. Ray Seddon, former NASA astronaut and assistant chief medical officer at the Vanderbilt Medical Group in Nashville, Tennessee. Her husband, Robert Gibson, is among the astronauts being inducted into the Astronaut Hall of Fame today. And congratulations. Give him our congratulations from Science Friday.
I certainly will, Ara. Thanks.
Thank you. Stephanie Nolan, author of The Promised the Moon. You Promised the Moon. The Untold Story, The First Women in the Space Race. That's out next month from Four Walls, Eight Windows. She's also foreign affairs reporter for the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Ontario. We're going to take a short break. Change gears and come back and talking about spooky action at a distance. I'm not talking about stuff that you think of them talking about. We'll see you after this break.